ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You can't control what you don't understand. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm taking back control of my digital life. Join me as I track down my data, lock down my accounts, and learn how to fight back. Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to getting off the internet. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National at Adelaide Writers' Week. My name is Natasha Mitchell. It is fantastic to be joining you under the trees here on Kaurna Country, wonderful, beautiful Kaurna Country. The theme and the challenge that we've been given for the next hour is a mighty one. Australia's carbon capture, releasing fossil fuels' grip on our democracy. You reckon we'll do it in an hour?
We'll give it our best shot. Joining me on stage at the recent Adelaide Writers' Week, economist and author Richard Dennis, who is Executive Director of the Australia Institute, economist Ross Garno, whose name you'd know as head of two influential climate change reviews for government, amongst other roles. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Melbourne, and his latest books include Let's Tax Carbon and Other Ideas for a Better Australia, and Superpower, Australia's Low Carbon Opportunity. He is also a board director of the renewable energy company Zen Energy. Sarah Hanson-Young is Senator for South Australia and the Green spokesperson for Arts and Communications and Environment and Water. And freelance journalist Royce Kermelov's latest book is called Slick, Australia's Toxic Relationship with Big Oil.
Let's go back in time with you, Royce, to kick off. I think it's an interesting scene setter that your book offers us. What did you set out to investigate in Slick?
Yeah, so I mean, the story of how the oil and gas industry, these fossil fuel producers became so influential and became so tied up into every Australian institution, into our government, into our politics, into our schools, into every aspect of Australian life is fascinating. And in some ways, it's the ultimate true crime story, right? Because, you know, because these guys set out in 1953 when we had the first discovery of oil out the back of Western Australia. You had, like William Walkley, who gave his name to the Walkley Awards, which is our version of the Pulitzer Prize here, responsible for that. You had the guy who was responsible for teaching the U.S. tobacco industry to lie, like the U.S. oil industry, on hand, helping them set up this new shop and bringing public relations to Australia. So from this inception, this starting point, we have this long-running trajectory which leads us here today. And for me, when I set out to investigate this, I sought to understand how we got here. We talk a lot about state capture, we talk a lot about the revolving door, we talk a lot about influence, but one of the many questions I had was the question of how. How does this work? How did it develop? How did these people learn to use these strategies and tactics? And how did they put them to work? And when did they get good at this? And the story that unfolded as I went back through old company records, old tobacco industry records, old oil industry records, as I went back to look at, to kind of piece together what happened here, is fascinating. And what you have is a group of very strange, irascible engineer types who start off as a rabble.
Now, I did engineering.
Sorry, no disrespect.
Hold your fire.
But they started out kind of, a bit of a cantankerous bunch, and over time they gradually began to refine their process. They learn, and to the extent that one of the very first campaigns they ever ran, one of the very first strategies for cultivating influence with politicians and government bureaucrats was by buying them drinks. Because in the early stages, there were these big conferences being held, and the government geologists were not allowed to attend because there was meant to be a firewall between them. The idea is a separation of church and state, so no one gets mixed loyalties. And the oil industry people saw this, were very mad about it, felt very insulted. But their solution was, okay, well, this ban applies to the conference, but it doesn't apply to drinks, right? So why don't you come to the pub afterwards, and oh, by the way, my boss is going to be there, and we can have a chat about, where we might find oil. And so, and it was a hugely successful strategy that's continued today. So, and then you run that across the timeline up through the, you know, the 70s and the 80s, and what you learn is that these people were aware of climate change. They were aware of climate change and the risk it posed as early as 1972 or 1969.
And they were hearing that from their own scientists.
From their own scientists.
But at what point did they start to take, and Exxon was doing the same. They had in-house researchers doing, you know, important work looking at the impact of their industry on global heating.
Absolutely.
But at what point did they then take a cue from where Exxon headed next, which was to become really a very skilled purveyor of misinformation and other hijinks around the impact of fossil fuels?
So in that early history as well, it's important to say that early on there was no controversy around this. When this research was being done from the 50s and 60s, the idea that climate change was happening wasn't a... these people that were involved, they were, you know, for better or worse, men of industry. They could solve this problem through their, you know, engineering nous, their scientific knowledge. It was in the 80s when you get this change of guard, this change of leadership at the top of Exxon, and that then flows down through the rest of industry. And even within Australia, within the industry associations, where, you know, people start putting two and two together, they start to say, right, well, if people get really concerned about this greenhouse effect thing and all this carbon going into the atmosphere, they're eventually going to come for us. They're going to come for oil production, gas production, and we just invested millions of dollars in this. So we need to engage in what is, you know, technically known as a campaign of product defense. We need to shut this down. We need to kind of confuse the matters. And so you start to see these marketing departments generate these campaigns to confuse the science of climate change. And this culminates through the early 90s when you have this dedicated campaign to act like the science is uncertain, to act like we don't know what was going on, despite the fact that you had companies like Exxon, you know, with these incredible research programs and collecting hard data on this, and we're getting warnings from their own scientists that this was happening. But the goal in the 90s was to just obfuscate, just to deny it, and that's part of what we know. And this was also carried out in Australia. You had this happen through the organisation formerly known as the Australian Petroleum Production Exploration Association, through the Australian Petroleum Institute. And they were very good at getting these documents that cast doubt on the science in front of policymakers and slipping it into briefs and having that becoming the dominant narrative that has, in fact, defined much of Australian climate discussion and politics for the last 20, 30 years.
I just want to put another question to you and then I'll come to the rest of the panel, because I think this is important historical context for what we'll talk about next. But an interesting point that you make in your book, Slick, is that... in fact, the fossil fuel industry, you claim, had more access to the political arena, to politicians and bureaucrats, than perhaps they even did in the USA. On what basis?
Yes, so, and this comes from the good work of Guy Pearce, who, you know, others at the Australian Institute.
Who did a phenomenal PhD.
Yes, he did a PhD.
Ex-Liberal staffer.
Yes, and he went around and because he was an ex-Liberal staffer, he had access to all these people and he would go and talk to them and with their permission, he recorded the conversation. And they were quite open with him because they were talking among friends. And the stuff he found, and his PhD, you can go and read it, by the way, and it's a gift that keeps giving. This thing is filled with 1,000 different outrages, but one of them is this claim from the Australian industry themselves that they had cultivated the art of influence so much better than their American counterparts. In the US, they bragged, the industry people had to sit outside the room. In Australia, they're inside the room. They're in the meeting. They're at the table. They're directing the creation of policy. And they bragged that, you know, it wasn't just the people that were making the decisions. They bragged that they had access to the people that were, you know, lower down the food chain, that would then pass up the information and should, you know, as it was being produced. One person Pierce interviewed even went so far as to claim that he had written a ministerial brief in himself that was then passed to the minister rather than the, you know, bureaucrat responsible for doing this. The zenith of this took place during the 90s, and it was in that period where we're discussing things like a carbon tax, discussing things like, you know, what do we do about this, how emissions reduction, and it came about right at that time when suddenly there was a big halt to this, a stop to efforts to address this.
Okay.
And I guess the good news before we carry on is that since then, that finesse has faded. It's not as influential anymore, but there are still elements of that around. And I think that's what we're kind of still grappling with today.
So, Senator Hansa-Young, is the fossil fuel industry taking you out to the pub for drinks?
I don't think I'm Gina's
best
friend.
And if not, why not?
Look, I think what Royce's book describes is something that we've all kind of known, but when you see that it is such a orchestrated, deliberate campaign of propaganda, of misinformation, all designed to stop progress in terms of, you know, towards a decarbonised economy, you know, that's what makes it shocking. It's not just kind of people not being bothered to listen to the facts. It's a deliberate strategy.
But you wouldn't deny that the fossil fuel industry has to have a relationship with policymakers,
oh,
given that we're reliant on their products.
And look, let me say, you know, the last few months has been very interesting on this front. We've been working hard to try and get some important environmental law reform through the parliament. And I'm sure people would have heard some of the news and fallout of that. I was in negotiations with the government for months about trying to at least salvage some of their promises, the need to protect nature because it is under so much threat. They'd already caved once to the fossil fuel industry. And, you know, and it's not just me saying this. They crowed about it. It was on the front pages of the Western Australian and the Australian newspaper. And so I was working really hard to try and get some remnants of laws that would actually make a difference. And when we were right on the cusp of delivering a deal that could pass the parliament, there were fossil fuel lobbyists walking the halls of parliament, calling MPs' offices, you know, and right to the top. Phone calls going right into the Prime Minister's
office. So they'd see that as their job to represent their industry?
Well, yes, of course, but at what cost? And I ask this because I think, you know, this is the role of parliaments, the role of democracy is to, and as a politician, you've got to make decisions that are in the best interest of the people. And what we're seeing is that the stranglehold that the fossil fuel industry has on Australian politics is not in the best interests of Australians. It's certainly not in the best interests of the planet. It's in the best interests of a handful of people's profits and not wanting to change. And that's what we have to get to the heart of. These are people who they know the environment is breaking down. They know the climate. It's not that climate change is coming. It is here. It is here. And they are hanging on to everything with dear might. Ads running through the newspapers, all over people's social media feeds, big billboards at airports, all about trying for the fossil fuel industry, whether it's Santos or Tamboran or Woodside, they are trying to buy the social license because they know that increasingly the community is seeing what's really going on. And we need to tackle that. I think the greenwashing that has come, it's always been there as Royce describes, but it is in full swing now in Australia because this is their last attempt to stop the changes. Just need to open up the newspaper last week and see the fossil fuel lobby are arguing against a minority government because they don't want the Greens there to hold Labor to account and their feet to the fire and implement policies and make the changes that are needed to save the environment, save the planet and reduce pollution. They don't want a minority government because it won't suit their profit margins.
But I did open the newspaper last week, well, metaphorically, and I noticed that BP is winding back its renewable efforts, which was a massive focus for BP, and is going to scale up its fossil fuel operations again. What do you make of that, Richard Dennis?
Well,
what signal is that sending? What do you think has been the impetus for that shift on behalf of BP after a very concentrated effort on their behalf to tilt towards renewables?
Yeah, well, I guess I don't think there's been any shift. There's just been a shift in PR strategy, right? Let's be clear. We've been warned for, you know, decades, 50 years, that if you keep burning fossil fuels, you get climate change. 50 years minimum. But let's just talk about the last 30 where the, you know, policymakers in Australia have struggled. There's been no decarbonisation in Australia at all. We pollute more now than we did in 1990. We're still opening new gas. We're still opening new coal. We've just subsidised a new gas-fired power station in Curry Curry in New South Wales. So the greenwash The meta greenwash is to pretend we've started moving away from fossil fuels.
The government when we're say, actually in response to that, though, the government say that that's about a transition process. That's about not letting letting go of existing international customers.
Let me go first. All right, that's the point. They're lying.
I got to play the devil's advocate here, folks.
All right, well, the devil doesn't need an advocate when you've got a PR budget that big, because day in and day out, the fossil fuel industry that's, let's be clear, makes tens of billions of dollars selling our fossil fuels and making a fortune on it, it's trivial for them to spend billions on PR. It's trivial for them to sponsor every airport. It's trivial for them to sponsor every sporting ground. You know, the Adelaide Cathedral's got gas wells in its stained glass. Stained glass, they're everywhere. So you're right, they're saying, there is no transition taking place. Can we just own that? If you're still opening new gas, you're not transitioning away from gas. There is no transition.
I want to come to Ross Garnaut because you've been right at the heart of this conversation for many decades now, and just thinking about this idea of state capture, which is the focus of this session, we could go in all sorts of directions on this topic. But take us back to the emissions trading scheme that we had put in place that existed for 2 years that got shut down in 2014, the night before we were due to integrate with Europe's emissions trading scheme. Describe what the fossil fuel industry's influence on that was.
Well, that was part of the story. It wasn't the only part. There were genuine believers that scientific physics was crap in the government that got rid of carbon pricing. They're on record as saying that, and they probably didn't need the vested interest to get them enthusiastic about damaging something that was hugely in the Australian interest, but the fossil fuel industry was part of the picture. The large industry organisations, the Mining Industry Council, were very effective in promoting a story against emissions pricing. In my book, I look at the issues from a different angle, and we're still a democracy. We've still got a chance, given what's happening in some other parts of the world. We've got to fight for that chance. We can't depend on it staying with us. But we've still got one now. We can still elect a government sometime in the next few months that can get serious about climate change. That's our choice as citizens at this time in history. And I think the big challenge, and the challenge that I talk about mainly in the book, is the challenge of securing the truth in a post-truth world. One, there are scientific truths, there are economic truths, and these are not repealed by an act of parliament. If you've got Trump in the United States or Abbott in Australia saying that climate science is rubbish, that doesn't change the effect of higher greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. It remains true that average global temperatures will keep increasing until we're down to net zero. And if we delay for 30 years, it'll keep getting warmer for 30 years longer. It's only when we get to net zero. That's a scientific truth. That's not affected by the propaganda. That's not affected by a rule of the Australian Parliament. And I also in the book try to focus on economic truths. One economic truth is that in Australia, and particularly in South Australia, there's very great economic opportunity for getting on with the job and getting on quickly. So there's a lot of publicity about the future of the Whyalla Steelworks in South Australia the last couple of weeks. There's no way that a steelworks in Whyalla can be competitive if all of the world depends on fossil carbon to reduce the iron. But if the world is going to net zero, then that can be a globally competitive location. So that's the economic truth. And the big challenge for us in this country, still a democracy despite the challenges elsewhere, is to make sure the truth, the scientific truth and the economic truth, gets a good hearing in our elections.
You talk in a very powerful way in the book about a palpable shift for you in which vested interests informed policy more than the public interest. What shifted in Australia and how do we shift that back? So, and in particular, you talk about the role of knowledge in policy making.
Yes, I think that there has been a deterioration in Australian political culture over the very long period in which I've been involved in public policy. I think it's harder now for the truth to get a hearing. It's easier now for vested interests seeking to obscure the truth to influence outcomes. A whole lot of things have contributed to that. One is that vested interests have become better at investing in the political process. Through experience, they've become better at it over time.
Donations buy everything, is what you're saying there, Ross.
Yeah, donations and many other channels. They become more effective at it. And that's led to a deterioration in economic performance, in economic policy and economic performance. And I make the point that productivity growth and rising incomes in Australia ended in 2013 with the election of the Abbott government. There's been no rise in real wages since 2013. That's unlike any previous period in Australian history. That happened because we didn't have the economic policies that gave us rising incomes, and that was partly a reflection of the increased role of vested interests. The degree of difficulty is harder today. We've got to recognise that in the world of information technology, where it's harder to get a national conversation about the truth. We've divided our political conversation into a lot of separate conversations divided by everyone going to the information that they seek.
Well, that's the difficulty of this moment. I mean, the eras that you talk about in the book are eras where there was a national, you know, there were newspapers that everyone flocked around. Everyone read the one source of information, watched the 7:30 report at night. You know, there were these sort of watering holes where people were able to get information. And I will come back to you because I think you talk about two examples in Australian history, post-war, 1945, and also the 80s under the Hawke government, where actually policy was made in the public interest over and above vested interests. And I'll be interested to hear you reflect on that. Sarah Hanson-Young, you want to pick up?
I just wanted to pick up on that point about truth. And it is very clear that the propaganda machine from the fossil fuel industry is being propped up, supported and facilitated by the Murdoch press in this country. And they have been doing that for a long, long time. And there's no better example than at the end of last year where the News Corp Daily Telegraph papers, so including the Advertiser and others around the country, had pages and pages of paid advertising, sponsorship by the fossil fuel industry, with articles written under the byline of their own journalists as ads. So when you open up the paper and you'd read this article, byline of a regular journalist, and it's all about how wonderful the gas industry is here in Australia. And that's not just buying advertising, it's buying propaganda and buying journalism. And that's a big part of the battle here. And so when we think about, you know, what politicians need to be able to do when you're in the community and you're talking to your local MPs or, you know, community leaders, we need to be actually finding avenues to call out that type of so obvious propaganda and mistruths. And there's no surprise that the campaign in this upcoming election is to stop those of us who want to see an end to new coal and gas not being elected or to have our power diminished. It is a deliberate strategy of the gas industry, of the fossil fuel industry and of the Murdoch press, and be aware of it, and we have to call it out.
Royce Kermeloves, and then I'll come to you, Richard. Royce Kermeloves, you go to the fossil fuel industry meetings, or the oil industry meetings in particular, don't you? You're inside those conference rooms, you're going to the lunches and sussing out what they're saying. At face value, the Australian Energy Producers Association, the old APA, So that's, what, 17 companies and seven industry associations. They have say that they've embraced the goals of the Paris Agreement. What are they saying inside those behind closed doors about the future of their industry?
Well, it's actually a very good question. And to pick up on what Sarah was saying, so as part of research for the book, I was going around to the, because, you know, I'm some guy. They're not going to, an oil and gas CEO is not going to sit down with me. So I started going to these oil and gas industry conferences to see what they were saying and to watch and to listen. And, you know, people say the damnedest things when they think they're amongst all their friends. And over the last 18 months, over the 18 months of researching the book, and as I was going to these conferences and listening to these conversations and listening to their plans, two things struck out to me. The first was that, for a time at least, after the recent federal election, the gas industry in particular was depressed. They were terrified. They were at the lowest point in generations. These are people that they'd organized an earlier transition. They had paid for every oven in Adelaide to be upgraded to take natural gas. They knew what it took to do a transition, and they had secured it, and they had made millions and billions of dollars off that work. But they were sitting around these rooms being very depressed, saying how Alba was going to come and kill their industry and put them up against the wall. And it didn't happen. And the second thing that started to happen towards the end of the book is that there started to be this real focus from these people on talking back and speaking louder. And I believe those words, we will speak louder, were actual words that were used. What we've seen so far is the creation of this advertising campaign we're seeing now, because these people know the end is nigh. These people know that climate change is real. Well, most of them, there are some true believers around who still insist that, you know, gas is forever. But these people know that the clock is ticking. And the whole game is to slow down the transition for as long as possible and make it out with as much cash as possible. And then to say, right, guys, you're on your own now. Good for you with your, you know, green transition. We're going to go holiday in Barbados or wherever. And I think what we're looking at this next federal election is a real question, even potentially a kind of sliding doors moment where, you know, we're going to find out whether the investment these companies are putting into this election and to create this idea that gas is forever, to create the idea that gas brings prosperity, to create the idea that gas is a transition fuel, which is not, by the way. When we export gas to Asia as part of this plan, it actually displaces more renewables than coal. For every unit of coal displaced, two units of renewables are displaced. And so we're about to see a test of whether that campaign will stick. And I think the ultimate answer to this is more democracy. And I think there are plenty of people in this audience who are deeply concerned about this. There are people, as I write about in my book, the people who lived in Lismore on the Northern Rivers, who woke up at 3 a.m. with the muddy chocolate soup of the flood rising up through their floorboards, who one woman described to me walking out onto her balcony and finding a cow stuck in a tree and then got swept away and pressed up against her balcony. And her house was one of those Queenslanders that were, you know, raised off the ground. So you can just imagine the absurdity of this situation. You know, and then even more recent disasters. I mean, there have been bushfires in Western Australia. There have been, you know, droughts. This is happening now. And I think there is enough concern, enough impetus to do something. It's just a question, it's just going to be very interesting to see whether that culminates into change, or we're at another point where we get set back another 4 years, another 8 years, another 10 years potentially.
Well, and the impact of what Dutton's plan is, Peter Dutton's plan, which he didn't come up with that himself. Right? Peter Dutton didn't wake up one morning and go, you know what, I'm gonna be the pro-nuclear guy, I want nuclear power. It was put to him as a delay tactic to slow down the transition away from fossil fuels. It's quite obvious that that is what has happened. Well, they've been propagating this for years, and finally they found a sucker who would be prepared to do it.
From the recent Adelaide Writers' Week, Natasha Mitchell here, bringing you ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. We are interrogating the fossil fuel industry's long influence on policy in Australia with economists Richard Dennis and Ross Garnaut, Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, and Royce Kermelovs, author of Slick, Australia's Toxic Relationship with Big Oil. Let's look at the process of extracting public policy, the process of making public policy from the extractive industries. Before we dive right into that, and there's some really interesting examples from history, What about the Trump situation? Again, the work he's pulled out of the Paris Agreement, and again, the world will pay attention to that.
Well, I'm an optimist. Change is possible, change is inevitable, and if you think it doesn't matter who you vote for, look at Donald Trump. Now, this is important, right? Because on the one hand, oh, it doesn't matter who I vote for, we're all stuck with the world as it is, it's so hard to get change. Yeah, right. Right? Who you vote for matters a lot. Now, if you were trying to keep things the way they are, if you were trying to maintain the status quo, if you were trying to suggest that change is impossible, wouldn't I tell you that it doesn't matter who you vote for? Wouldn't I tell you that governments can't make a difference? So the fact that Trump has been elected is proof that democracy matters, because he was elected, whether you like it or not, more people voted for him than voted for the Democrats. And to give you a simple example of how important democracy is here, the choices our parliament makes on our behalf matter. In Norway, they tax the hell out of the fossil fuel industry and they give their kids free higher education. In Australia, we subsidise the fossil fuel industry and charge our kids a fortune to go to uni. Who we elect matters. The choices, the decisions, the policies our elected representatives make on our behalf with our money matter. And Royce is right. All the fossil fuel industry is doing is playing for time.
Yeah.
Every day is a profitable day. Australia is a generous country, a very generous country. We give away more than half of our gas exports for free to foreign gas companies. Little plucky little startups, Chevron, BP, Inpex. Literally half the gas, more than half the gas Australia exports is royalty free, and we collect more tax, we collect more revenue from HEX than we do from our petroleum resource rent tax. No, you voted for that. Maybe not you, but that person sitting next to you.
Are you trying to start a riot?
Now,
let me finish. To be clear...
We don't want a riot on our hands.
But if we wanted to change that, we could. There's nothing constitutional stopping this.
So let's look at where we have made policy decisions in the public interest and politicians have had to stare down or actively ignore vested interests in order to do that. And one example that your colleague Polly Hemming, who couldn't be with us today because she has COVID, I gather, poor thing, sorry Polly, cites is gun law reform in this country. So is that a powerful and potent example of what could be possible?
I mean, it's kind of staggering to think that our democracy is so broken we think we've never done anything hard in the past. We used to do whaling, and when we ended it, you know what the whaling industry felt? Sad. We used to mine asbestos, and when we stopped mining asbestos, you know what the asbestos industry felt? Sad. We've done all sorts of things. We had a free trade agreement with the US. Thank God that will keep us safe now. All right. Thank God we did that, which led to tens of thousands of people, mainly migrant women working in the textiles industries, losing their jobs because we thought it was in the interest of the economy for tens of thousands of people working in the textile industry to lose their jobs in the interest of the economy. We've done so many hard things, including regulate tobacco, which made the tobacco industry sad, and including John Howard in an act of political bravery after a massacre where someone killed someone with a machine gun, and we banned automatic weapons in Australia. And the National Party didn't like it, and the gun industry didn't like it, and he did it anyway. So to believe that we can't expect modern generations of politicians to do their job and be brave, that's what kills democracy.
We hope to come to you in about 5 minutes for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, come up to that mic and line up. Ross Garnaut, you also cite examples where politicians have either ignored or stared down vested interests in the past to make courageous policy that makes a really dramatic change in Australian life. So give us some of the examples from history that you lean into.
But there's two big ones that where, two big episodes where Australian policy really worked and set up Australia for a generation of rising incomes and improving standards of living. They stand out in our history because we've had a lot of times when things haven't worked so well. But the two periods are post-war reconstruction and the era of reform that began with the election of the Hawke government in 83. Both of them did very hard things. And I think we can learn lessons from looking back at that period. Look at the common elements. First, it requires clear-headed leadership and strong leadership, but it won't happen without that. And we had it with the Curtin and Chifley prime ministerships, followed by the Menzies prime ministership. You need a lot of clear-headed analysis, and the system of advice to government matters for that, making good use of a highly professional public service. That was a common element. You don't get it without big efforts by government in public education, explaining the public interest in change, explaining why it's better for the country as a whole some decisions are taken that hurt particular interests. And you don't get it without those leaders being prepared to take a risk. And
so that education interest issue is very interesting to me, because that is actually about actively engaging in a difficult conversation with the public about consequential policy options, isn't it?
Yeah.
And at the moment, you get this sense that politicians are too scared to do that. Once the cat's out of the bag, they might lose at the polls.
Yes, I think that some very big political mistakes are being made now. We've got much more political systems of immediate advice to prime ministers and to government than we used to have. People surrounding the prime minister's dominating advice tending to be much more sensitive to their perceptions of the immediate political pluses and minuses than we used to have. And I think that ends up being bad politics, because it means that you're not able to put yourself in a position to articulate strongly and clearly ideas in the national interest, and then get the benefit sometime later of those ideas actually working. If you're forever reacting against the political moment, then you won't capture the enthusiasm of the electorate that will give you a majority of support to carry you through change, even though some parts of the community might be threatened, might feel threatened by that change.
So how should politicians, in your mind, navigate those perceived threats, perceived or actual threats,
I think
to their political future?
I think it is best handled by a very clear-headed analysis, identification of things that will actually work, and then explanation of why they will work. And that's a big job. Bob Hawke talked about, in 100 speeches, talked about the importance of reducing protection. He did that for 3 years before he started to reduce protection. And by the end of that time, people knew the reasons why he was doing that, and you can contrast that with the sudden unexplained 25% tariff cut of the Whitlam government, which came out of a clear blue sky. So that is really the prime example in our history of public education preparing the community for bigger change.
Yes, and thinking about the impact of public education today in the context of the era of social media, we're in such a different time, aren't we, Senator Sarah Hanson-Young?
We are.
I mean, just let's then head inside the political culture of our time, and what would it take to stare down vested interests in the name of the public interest?
Well, I've seen a few examples of where this hasn't happened recently, and I cited the environment law reform as one example. Fossil fuel industry, Gina Rinehart went very hard on it, and the government blinked and dumped their own promise, their own law. It's been withdrawn from the parliamentary paper. They don't want to talk about it because they're worried it's going to annoy the big business and fossil fuel industry, particularly in WA. The other example is gambling, advertising law reform. And this is something where the public clearly want a change. There was a promise, there was a unanimous report across the parliament for a ban on the advertising of gambling, and it's been left. And the Labor Party have been crab walking away, despite the fact that if we got it done, if Parliament was recalled tomorrow and we walked in, we would have the numbers to do it, if the Labor Party and the government were prepared to follow through. The lobby in that instance has been huge and has really put a break. But this is why I think, Natasha, you know, the last election, a third of voters didn't vote for the Labor Party or the Liberal Party, right? A third of the country said, we don't want this, we want something else. They voted for the Greens, they voted for some independents, they voted against the interests of the Labor Party and the Liberal Party. And I predict that this election, there'll be even more.
So
it'll be it'll be more than a third. It'll be a wave of people who want action and people who expect. And there's all this fear-mongering going on about a minority government. You know, the fossil fuel industry are out there saying it's going to be terrible. Yes, it will be terrible for you guys. I'm going to do something about it. You know, they're up in arms, whipping up a storm of fear. You'll hear over the next few weeks, you know, Peter Dutton denouncing a minority government and how terrible that's going to be. You'll hear the Prime Minister saying he doesn't want that. The only real thing is a majority. I tell you what, it's not in the interest of the Australian people and the community. What is in the interest is having people there to hold government to account, to negotiate good outcomes, and to ensure that the community has a voice, not just these vested interests of these big corporations. They've had a go. It's time for you to have a go.
So, though, to come back to you on that, are independents and the Greens immune from vested interests?
I think the advantage of the Greens and the independents is that, one, we're very careful about what donations we take. Obviously, you need money to run an election campaign, but we're very upfront about who we take money from. We don't take money from the fossil fuel industry. We won't take money from the alcohol industry. We won't take money from the tobacco lobby. We won't take money from gambling, despite the fact that Labor and Liberals still do. No wonder there's no ban on gambling ads. Hundreds of thousands of dollars have passed from the gambling industry to Labor and Liberal over the last 12 months. So we're clear about that. But the other thing is, we know that the only reason we are there is because people trust us. They work hard on the ground. It's people power. And they trust us to do what we say and say what we do. When you talk to people about in the community as voters about how they feel about Labor or Liberal, people expect the Liberal Party to be pro-big business and not really care about the environment or care about climate or care about other things. That is their view. And that's because that is the attitude that Peter Dutton and the Liberal Party have cultivated and are cultivating. When they talk about the Labor Party, they want Labor to be better. That Labor voters are disappointed, they're terrified of Dutton, but they want Labor to be better. And they're starting to look at the Greens and independents as insurance, because just leaving it up to the old two parties is not working, and they want something new, and that's what we're offering.
But Richard Dennis, big business employs Australians. When the government talks about engaging with big business, when they get accused of kowtowing to vested interests, they will articulate that big business is an employer, it is an income earner, it's a revenue generator for this country. That's an important...
Good if some of them paid some tax.
Yeah.
Okay.
Look, of course government should engage with business. The question is, after they've engaged, on whose behalf do they then go and make decisions?
Yeah.
Let's be clear, in Australia, yes, some big businesses employ a lot of people. Some big businesses employ almost no people. Google's a big business, doesn't employ a lot of people here. The gas industry that we started talking about today, all up. You're looking at maybe 30,000 jobs. Unitingcare employs more people than the gas industry. Anglicare employs more. So talk to those big businesses.
Yeah.
Go on, like it's not like we've got this picture that there's these big businesses that are, you know, the fossil fuel industry and everyone else is kind of doing something that's supported by that. you know, Ross made the really important point before about truth. Well, according to top secret data held by something called the Australian Bureau of Statistics on their website, the gas industry employs far less people than McDonald's, far less people than the average, you know, than the aged care providers you've heard of. But in Australia, we're told that they're the backbone of the economy. Well, I don't know about you, Ross, but in all my years studying economics, I missed the lesson about the backbone. Right? Because you know what? When economists talk to each other, we're spineless, okay? Right? There is no backbone. But when you can spend billions on PR, when you can sponsor every stadium, and I didn't say build every stadium, right? They just pay 100 grand to stick the ad up there. Taxpayers spend 2 billion on the stadium. They slap an ad up for 100 grand and we name it after them. No, it'd never work, would it? All right. So we don't actually understand our economy because we were never taught about it. We don't actually go to the ABS website because, frankly, who would? But when the newspapers are chock full of full page ads saying we're the backbone of the economy, your kids' jobs are owed to us, well, the person sitting next to you is persuaded by that. So yes, okay, big business should have a voice talking to government. Yes, small business should have a voice talking to government. Yes, the community should have a voice. No one's saying they shouldn't have a voice. The question is, should we listen to science? Should we listen to the public? Or should we just get bullied around by the fossil fuel industry?
All right, I want to come to questions. And it's no coincidence that the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and indeed the Census, were both, hamstrung with budget cuts, etc.
Yep.
You know, we need good data to shine a light, always, is my feeling as a journalist. And a science journalist. Let's come to questions.
Thank you very much, panel. So much learned today. That word community, my question being, with people like Paul Kelly writing Sleep Australia Sleep, Tim Winton writing Juice, which is an absolute knockout, must be read, what do you guys see as the role of the creative author or photographer or singer in our community today? Thank you.
And it's interesting, if you're at WOM Adelaide, Tim Winton and Rachel Perkins are joining me next Saturday on that very question. Any responses?
I think it's a fundamental part of how we deliver social change. Storytelling is one of the most powerful tools we've got. And there's a reason why conservative right-wing politicians want to shut down our artists and want to censor our artists. And they shouldn't. They shouldn't be able to get away with that. We need our writers, we need our performers, we need our storytellers, because not just to reflect what's going on in the world, but to reflect what could be going on if we wanted to change and wanted to do it better.
I'd just add that, you know, fiction is so important. Without fiction, where would the PR industry be? So good writers have got a really important role to play in that version of fiction, because, boy, we're flooded with that other fiction.
Thank you. Your question.
Oh, good morning, panel. It's been great to hear you. The issue that hasn't been mentioned here, I feel, is shareholders. We've talked about voters in a democracy, but shareholders have not been mentioned. Could you please tell me results of any analysis of shareholders which might encourage people here, because without making the audience uncomfortable as to asking who has shares in BP, we could ask more about how to change to ethical shareholdings, how to encourage people to get money out of renewables in a way that encourages them to leave those fossil fuels behind. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And shareholders, I mean, that's a form of vested interest, isn't it? I'll come back to that. I just want to grab one more question. I'm going to grab you in pairs if I can.
Simple one. Are we too well off for our own good?
Well, there's two questions for you. Certainly some shareholders are. Ross Garno.
No, we're not too well off for our own good. Some Australians might be, but lots aren't, and we need to have them richer. And on the shareholder question, the big voluntary action by people in the community can be very important, can be very helpful, and it has been in recent years when policy has not been strong. But voluntary action is not going to get us to the solution we need to the climate problem. We need that voluntary action by individual shareholders, but we need strong government policy. You can't get all the way on voluntary action.
Does anyone want to pick up on it? Would be great. Yep.
Oh, just very quickly, you know, if your super fund's invested in coal and gas, maybe switch super funds. It's not complicated. But on all your behalf, the Australian government's future fund, your future fund's got $300 billion of your dollars in a fund. It's a very, your fund, your future fund, which you can't get out of unless you quit your Australian citizenship, is a very major investor in oil and coal and gas. It's a very big shareholder in Whitehaven Coal. And last week it estimates the government or the future fund executive were asked about, you know, how are you invested in Whitehaven? What are you doing? How are you voting your shares? Commercial in confidence couldn't possibly tell you. It's your money. It's your money. And the people who are managing your money are telling you, when asked in the Senate, couldn't possibly tell you. You know, greater minds than yours have puzzled over this, so you butt out. It's appalling.
Two more questions. Thank you.
I was arrested at Rising Tide in Newcastle, stopping the coal ships. What's the value of direct action in this? It happens, needs to change now. Mm.
Royce.
On the shareholder question, what shareholders can do, right now there is a campaign to tank the share value of Tesla over Elon Musk's antics in the US. And it's incredibly effective. And it's an incredibly interesting attack service from a campaign or an organization perspective. And I think that's kind of shows the extent that these institutions seem so big, so insurmountable, so, you know, too much to do anything about. But once that momentum builds, once that the call goes out, we really can see those changes happen. And you can do that in every aspect of your life, whether it's your shareholding, whether it's through direct action, you know, for Rising Tide, whether it's at your local school when Santos wants to sponsor an education program. A woman I interviewed once was scratching off the Woodside logo from the swimwear that was sponsored by Woodside for the Nippers program, and letting her kid go to the thing with the, you know, texter across it. So there are so many things you can do in your own life. And this goes back to something we were saying before about this idea of democracy. I think it's incumbent on you, if you care about this and want change, is to demand at every interval, you know, I want my electricity grid, like 100% renewable energy. I want my EV chargers on every corner. I want, you know, my fossil fuel corporations taxed. That should be the message going out across the board, because it's not just politicians that ultimately decide this. They decide things based on what you authorize them to do. And if they sense that their job is in jeopardy because they're not doing anything, you have the power to do that, to demand that, and you should be doing that.
I just want to say how inspiring actually having so many people coming to this session is, because this is what actually the fossil fuel industry are worried about, is that the public is turning on, the public is aware, they know what the fossil fuel industry are doing. So when you show up and speak out, actually that's the best antidote to their greenwashing and their propaganda. Thank you.
And thanks to Adelaide Writers Week for having Big Ideas along. Today you heard from economist and author Richard Dennis, Executive Director of the Australia Institute, Emeritus Professor Ross Garno. He is author of Let's Tax Carbon and Other Ideas for a Better Australia and Superpower, Australia's Low Carbon Opportunity. He is also a board director of the renewable energy company Zen Energy. And you heard from Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young and journalist Royce Kermelobs, author of Slick, Australia's Toxic Relationship with Big Oil. My name is Natasha Mitchell. I'll be back at this year's Adelaide Writers Week. Check it out. Lots coming your way in Adelaide. Catch you next time for more Big Ideas. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.